I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and this is Writers and Company. Today, social analyst and writer Richard Sennett, an expert on cities and culture. His latest book is called Together: The Rituals, Pleasures, and Politics of Cooperation. Richard Sennett draws on ethnography, history, and social theory to develop his ideas about how we make sense of our environment, the cities we live in, and the work that engages us. As one critic in The Guardian put it, for many years, Sennett has been the Anglo-American world's most original and eloquent thinker on work and the workplace, streets and street life, the places where huge impersonal social forces intersect with an individual's fragile sense of self. Although Sennett teaches sociology at both the London School of Economics and New York University, he doesn't really write academic prose. As The Guardian critic went on to describe it, Sennett's writing is an elegant mix of interview, anecdote, and wide, deep book research. His key terms have to do with common personal predicaments, love and power, dignity and humiliation, impersonality and self-absorption, self-worth and self-blame. Richard Sennett's books include The Fall of Public Man, The Corrosion of Character, subtitled The Personal Consequences of Work in the New Capitalism, and Flesh and Stone, The Body and the City. 6 years ago, he embarked on a trilogy of books called Homo Faber, or Man the Maker, about the skills people need to sustain everyday life. He began with The Craftsman, examining how the work of the hand informs the work of the mind. Sennett offers an original perspective on craftsmanship, the desire to do a job well for its own sake, and its close connection to work and ethical values. The second volume looks at the practical skill of communication and cooperation. It's called Together: The Rituals, Pleasures, and Politics of Cooperation. The last in the trilogy, still to come, is about the physical environment, how to make cities. Richard Sennett was born in Chicago in 1943. He had an unusual childhood as the son of communist parents, raised by a single mother in a housing project where they were one of the few white families. Oh, and he was also a musical prodigy, giving concerts on the cello when he was scarcely a teenager. I spoke to Richard Sennett when he was in Toronto last year for the Luminato Festival. When did you first become aware of cooperation as a behavior in your own life?
I think probably at the age of 6 and a half. And that's when I started playing music with other kids. I was trained as a musician, and I think at 6 and a half was the first time I played a string quartet.
Really? And how did it start? I know you started at a school piano, but how did you get from that to...
It was very unlikely because my mother wasn't at all musical. But I was going to a Catholic school near the housing estate that we lived on, and it had a piano. And I started banging around on the piano, and evidently I banged well. And then I actually heard, my mother had she had some Public Assols 78s, we're talking long ago, and I thought that's what
we're talking
I
the late 40s.
Late 40s, early 50s. And I thought that's what I wanted to do. So I asked to play a cello when I was about 5, and I played a little 1/8-size cello. I mean, I barely get my hands around it. Anyhow, after about 1.5 or 2 years, I started playing with other kids. You know, when you play a musical instrument, when you first start, in those days, you sat alone in a room and practiced your scales and arpeggios and so on, which we don't do with children today. We get them started right away playing with other kids. But I had to wait about 1.5 years to do that. And it was a shock.
To play in a quartet.
Yeah, because it wasn't about how well physically I could get all the notes out, but about listening to other people and so on. And not trying to shine all the time, which little kids want to do. Listen to me, you know, and so on.
And where did you find this, like a pickup string quartet in the projects?
This was an amazing thing. I mean, I grew up in what became one of the most notorious slums in the States, the Cabrini Green housing project. But it became notorious in the 60s and early 70s when drugs arrived in the project. Before that, it was just lots of poor people. And it was looked after, mostly black, but we were a mixed group. But it was looked after by the Catholic Church. So they had a school there. They're very tough nuns, as I remember. And if you showed any sign of wanting to do something like make music, they encouraged it. And you can imagine for African-American children who'd grown up in the South or whose parents had grown up in the South where everything was denial, there's nothing left over for you. It was a kind of wonderland that these nuns and priests were suddenly, they wanted people to learn. You know, when I tell people about this housing estate, they always think, my God, you must have had a terrible childhood, because they think the thinking at a later period.
Deprivation, violence,
all of those racialized stereotypes. But in fact, we were very poor, but I had a happy growing up. You know, there were no trees. It was completely urban. But it felt, it felt good.
And
we weren't aware of being deprived, even though objectively we were.
And in terms of that sense of cooperation, did it feel natural to be with other kids playing?
No. Not at
all.
Is
it a learned skill?
It's learned, and that's what really my book about cooperation is about. I'm not going to give you a lecture on this, but I'll tell you briefly that a lot of studies that want to affirm that people have cooperative capacity say it's innate, it's in our genes, all you have to do is have goodwill and the skills will flourish. I think that's wrong. To me, the difficult kind of cooperation, which is cooperating with people you don't know or people you don't like even, people who are different, that complex kind of cooperation has to be learned. It's skills. And that's what I was going to say about the music. That's a beginning point in learning that something that may seem so simple to you, that somebody who plays a different instrument has different needs.
And you have to pay attention.
And you have to pay attention to that a violin is not a cello, unfortunately. At the most simple level, this is another sound different to me. And I think, what my book is about is that problem just blown up and expanded, that we are so convinced today that you can only cooperate with people who are like you, that we've lost this other dimension, which is the skill of getting along with people who are different, working with them.
So. I want to get into that shortly, but just going back to growing up in this housing project called Cabrini Green, it wasn't as bad as it became, but you've also said there was a kind of racial warfare going on there. How did you experience that?
Well, what you have to imagine is that ever since the beginning of this Jim Crow legislation, that black families were constantly holding in an enormous amount of rage. They were treated in some ways worse than they were under slavery, many of them.
Jim Crow legislation was post-Civil War, post-ostensible freedom.
It was a reimposition of segregation on economic and social lines. So during the Second World War, these families that had really been grounded into the dirt came up north. And the parents were, of course, still reeling from the fact that, people were lynched occasionally. The Ku Klux Klan was a potent force in the 1930s. So they were very worried that their kids were going to run out of control. But by a kind of osmosis, the kids picked up the fact that they could let some of this rage out. So I'll give an example of the sort of thing. There was something called the Glass Wars, in which I was a minor consigliere, in which black and white kids would get across the street from each other in abandoned buildings and sling panes of glass across the street. It was a pretty dangerous thing to do. And parents absolutely horrified at this, as you can imagine.
But this is along racial lines.
Completely. But I think it was that is just kind of, I don't know how it happens with little 7 or 8 year old kids, but they had understood that up north they could let more of it out. So one of the aspects of cooperation in that community was here are these poor blacks and poor whites, very different. They have these children which out of school are running in packs with each other. And they have to figure out a way to control their kids and keep order in the community. And my mom was pretty deeply involved in that because she was very poor because my father had abandoned her. So she was a single mother and she had no money and so on. But she was educated, a university educated person. And she said it was a real, I remember saying, I really learned about how to work with other people, not by going to social work school, but by figuring out how to keep people from killing each other in the streets. I mean, how you listen to somebody else in a way that's not over-empathic, for instance. If a white person said to a black person, oh, poor you, I know exactly what it feels like. Any reasonable black person would say, you do? How dare you presume? So that sort of white middle class guilt is very counterproductive.
And what's the alternative to being over-empathic? What's a more constructive alternative?
That's a form of sympathy, is identification with somebody else, as though you can understand what they're feeling. But the alternative to that is something that's a much cooler kind of empathy, properly speaking, which is you're curious about somebody else rather than identifying with them. It's cooler. You communicate to them that you're interested in what's up with them rather than that you and they are on the same page. And it's got a big penumbra about it in social thought, which is, if we're very sympathetic, let's say the proper word for it, and we're, you know, I feel just what you feel and so on, what we're doing is privileging solidarity. We're all in this together. And the more complex form of cooperation is, well, we can't all be in this together in the same way. So what is it that we do together, despite the fact that, as in the case of these blacks and whites, people didn't really understand each other. And it's a real big problem.
How did your mother do it?
I'll tell you how she did it. She had a pretty thick Russian accent. And this is very clever. She made use of that by saying to people, I'm not quite getting this. You'll have to excuse me. I'm a foreigner, which was credible because thick accent, which was a little manipulative, but it made people explain things to her because she was an outsider. And she did that all the way around. She did this with poor whites who were there. She did it with blacks. She genuinely meant it with many blacks because she'd never been in the South. So everybody was constantly sort of telling her what the score was. Now, they had different versions of that. But it was a very good community organizing tool. But, you know, in Chicago in the 50s, this was a grave issue. You had a lot of the black women, especially, who'd left the South to go work in these war factories. The war factories shut down. Jobs were scarce. The 50s was, it may in the suburbs have been Ozzie and Harriet and all of that. Certainly not in... The Depression really didn't end for poor people until late 60s. You know, it took a long time.
So the alternative to sympathy and And I know what you're going through, or I feel for you.
Yeah, feel your pain.
I feel your pain. Famous Clinton-esque remark. And pseudo-solidarity, the alternative to that, a better constructive alternative, is to listen, is to not presume, is to...
Yes, that's right. It's also, I mean, there's a technical side to what the alternative is. I'll give you an example. It's called dialogics, and it's about ways of speaking to other people who are unlike yourself in a way that you can carry on a conversation or perform a task. I'll give you an example of it. If I say to you, I think X, I'm absolutely convinced of X, and you say to me, really? Well, I'm absolutely convinced of Y. We disagree. We begin to debate. We may be very clear with each other what our own positions are, but we're not getting much from each other. The reason for that is a linguistic thing, which is the declarative tone of voice. The declarative voice, I believe X. If you change that to something like, I would have thought, or perhaps, by introducing a zone of ambiguity in people's relationships with each other, you create something social. Could it be the case that?
Oh, so it could even be not just a sociologically technical term, it could just be the linguistic subjunctive term.
Subjunctive.
If I were to think this, would I be along the right lines in relation to?
So, I mean, one of the things about cooperation, and there's a kind of lesson in this, one of the things about cooperation is that we imagine that people cooperate well the clearer they are with each other.
Not true.
Not true. You know, not true. You know this in scientific work. It's why really good scientists insist that the water cooler and the coffee maker is the most important tool in the lab. Because you're informally talking, you're not being assertive, you know, your job isn't on the line, it's not a question of your competence, what you believe, what you can prove, but you're just shooting the breeze. You have a very informal, and informality is a big part of dialogics, a thing in which there are no rewards or penalties. Using the subjunctive voice, you find out things from other people.
Using the Russian accent.
She was a genius at this. And it would grow, I saw in public. My mom went on to be, she worked for Hubert Humphrey, and she wrote a part of what was the, she had quite a distinguished career. She wrote what's called Medicaid B in American health law, which was for elderly poor people, was... gave them some backup. And I noticed whenever in public that she was describing this, that her accent got much thicker, you know.
How old was she when she came over from Russia?
Six.
Oh, really? Because usually you lose it by six. I mean, if you come earlier, it's more like 12.
Well, it depends how cunning you are.
Yes, I understand. And you mentioned that your father left your mother and you when you were an infant?
7 months old.
7 months old. So you have no siblings?
I have no... I have some illegitimate siblings, I think. My father evidently had a very active marital life and extramarital life. You know, but I grew up alone.
And he left... He was. He had fought in the Spanish Civil War?
They both had.
Both your mother and your father?
They were communists and they fought in the they met there. And they came back, and they separated, and then they got back together, and they had me to save the marriage, you know, that trope. And adorable as I am, it didn't do the trick. So.
And he went back to Spain?
No. He translated a lot of Catalan poetry. He was very poor. He lived in a trailer in Arizona. Did odd jobs and produced these books of translations of Catalan poetry. And I really don't know much about him because,
Did you see him when you were growing up?
I never met him.
You never met him?
He completely abandoned us. And I know all of this because I know his brother, my uncle, who looked at my father as this ne'er-do-well in the family, made contact with me when I was in university. So I got filtered all this information.
What place did your father have in your imagination?
Remarkably little. You know, I had lots of male role models around. We had a lot of men who were my mother's friends. And since she was, by that time, she was a public figure. She was in a band's world.
Public figure as an organizer, as a social worker?
As both. So there were lots of men around the house. And it was just naturalized to me, you know. I suppose in some deep psychological way, some Freudian would say, nonsense. You were missing him from the day you were one day older. I had a good childhood in some ways. An unusual one because I had this musical gift. And I was playing concerts when I was 13 or 14. You know, I had a kind of wonderful experience of, that's actually my first experience of Canada, was when I was 15. I played in something called the Minneapolis Bach Area Group. And we were a group of people who toured in a Volkswagen bus playing in churches Bach cantatas. And we went to Winnipeg when I was 16. These exhausted men who had been working in these horrible jobs all week. It was freezing cold. They were sleeping. It was wonderful. And we were playing this music, great music. And somehow...
Is this for laborers? Or was it,
yeah,
it was kind of like politically driven concerts?
And I didn't mind at all, you know. It was like we were helping them to rest, to sleep, and, you know, we were playing this music. So that was my first impression of Canada, was of these exhausted guys sort of snoozing through, I can't remember which cantatas we played, and windswept. I don't know if that kind of Canada still exists, but...
The windswept part still exists. How did you and your mother get out of Cabrini Green?
Well, she met Hubert Humphrey, and he got her a job in Minnesota. And it was amazing because, you know, in the mid-50s, the McCarthy thing had died down a bit, but it wasn't like it was just after the war. But an ex-communist could have a rough time. I think the fact that she was a woman oddly meant that somehow it didn't count.
She was less threatening.
Yeah, she wasn't really a communist.
And was she really a communist?
Or she was really a communist.
And how did she become an ex?
1939, the Hitler-Stalin Pact. For people, not just Jews, but I mean for many people, this was shattering. Just shattering. And the fact that Hitler then invaded Russia in 1941 didn't make up for it. I mean, these are communists outside of the USSR, obviously. But this is a whole world unto itself. You know, this extreme left, which I grew up in, was a little minuscule community, just a little group of people, most of whom very conflicted about their communism and the fact that they had joined this thing and left it. They still felt loyalty to their friends, even though they didn't feel any loyalty to the party. And they had this double trauma of McCarthy, the trauma of, you know, the God that failed, as it's communism has been called. Then they had McCarthy. And it was a very strange group. I had, for instance, I never read Winnie the Pooh. I had something called the Little Lenin Library. And this, you know, the stories of Spartacus and slave revolts, you know, Toussaint Louverture, you know, so on.
From Haiti. He was the Haiti revolutionary.
Haiti, yeah. And Spartacus, the ancient Roman slave who led a revolt. So It was a strange world, and we were called red diaper babies.
And did you continue as a kind of red inclined person?
Well, I guess I took in a lot of this by osmosis. I never thought about being left wing or not. I had a period when I was middle aged when I was. I don't like identity politics very much, so I sort of moved to the right. And with the growth of neoliberal capitalism, I moved back to the left. So I don't know what I am now. I'm certainly against neoliberalism, and I'm to the left of somebody like Obama. I can't stand all that kind of, you know, progressive, don't frighten the horses, just be nice, nudge.
Nudge so ineffectively that nothing happens.
Yeah. But as a kid, I took it for granted. This was what I knew. And the thing about Minnesota had this Farmer Labor Party. I don't know what the equivalent would have been here in Canada.
Probably the CCF.
Yeah, CCF. That would have been the same thing. So that had a lot of lefties, real lefties in it. And Hubert was... he was at ease with him. He was very anti-communist. But like Walter Reuther, who was the head of the CIO, it was a big auto union, they were anti-communist, but they didn't have this knee-jerk anti-communism.
So Hubert Humphrey got your mother a job in Minnesota, and you went along? You moved?
Well, we went there four or five years. Then I went back to Chicago to study with an incredible cellist named Frank Miller, who was the lead cellist in the Chicago Symphony. And I studied with him for a year. I enrolled in the University of Chicago, which was a terrible mistake. No artist should be in a monastic university like that. And then I went to New York, and I was playing concerts, but I was also studying, and it was this great event in my life. I began studying conducting because I was preparing for a school at Pierre Monteux, a very elderly at that time conductor, but still vigorous, ran in Maine. And then the Vietnam War struck, and I was drafted, and what I saw in front of me was a career of playing in the 7th Army Symphony, but I failed it. They thought I was too red, and also I was having a lot of hand problems by that time. So I went back to university after that. And the reason I became a writer was that I developed something that's like carpal tunnel syndrome. Do you know what that mm-hmm. is?
It's a strain
along your knuckle ridge, basically. And foolishly, I had it operated on, and the operation was a disaster. And that was the end of it. I can play, you know. Yeah. I play all right. I give the odd concert, but...
I have to ask you, how do you feel when... Like everything's from the age of 6 was in some level leading towards this.
It took a long time, maybe 55 years to recover.
Did you consider conducting?
Well, I wasn't as wise at 20 as I should have been. I sort of had a huge overreaction when I couldn't play anymore. And I should have just gone on to work as a conductor. But I thought, the hell with the whole thing, you know, and my life is over, and I'm going to have to start over again. And looking back, I would have just continued with Maestro Monteux. And
I ask about conducting because in some way it seems to embody your whole philosophy of cooperation.
It does.
You know, there's that collective activity for a common goal with incremental improvement and paying
right.
close attention.
And working with people's
and different
limits
levels of skill.
Absolutely. Now, this book on cooperation. I should have only written about orchestral work and serial music work. No, absolutely. But I like that. I mean, in order to be able to do that, if you're a conductor, some things are really necessary. One of them is a phenomenal memory. And the conductor is reading the score along with his players or her players. It's all over. So there are a real set of techniques. You know, the physical act of conducting is not so difficult. But the dance aspect of it and the performing aspect of it requires sets of techniques which are not about cooperation. I mean, you know, if you memorize, I memorized all of Carmen for a performance, you know, which was a nightmare. It's a special form of cooperation is what I'm saying. But the actual work of rehearsing, basically I think about cooperation as a rehearsal, not a performance.
That's a very nice metaphor. Richard Sennett with me in Toronto. He's my guest today on Writers and Company on CBC Radio 1, on Sirius Satellite Radio XM, and around the world on cbc.ca. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. So in lieu of becoming a conductor, you ended up studying sociology at Harvard.
I did, and by accident.
Why that?
I'd done a Bach cantata concert with Jenny Riesman, wonderful singer, whose father was David Riesman. And when I had this, you know, this disaster with my paw, he said, well, why don't you come to Harvard? You've had this ridiculous, I remember him saying this ridiculously left-wing background. Why don't you come to Harvard and study with me?
Now, Riesman was famous at the very big at the time of The Lonely Crowd.
Crowd, that's right. Which was the first sociological bestseller in the States. And you couldn't do that today. I mean, I had very little preparation, except for the little Lennon library. You know, I didn't know too much about a social life. And then I got interested in it. It's interesting. I mean, cities are interesting. How people work is interesting. How they cooperate is interesting. Academic sociology is a snooze. For me, it was not something I wanted to bother about. So I was working with him, and then I became... I can't say I was ever her student in any formal way, but I really fell under the influence of Hannah Arendt.
You met her through music, I think.
She came to one of my concerts, and I actually followed a course of hers, which I think I flunked. But she'd come to one of my concerts, and was sort of, I wasn't close to her in any way in the beginning. But every time I was in New York, I would see her. And after the Eichmann in Jerusalem thing, we became closer.
Eichmann in Jerusalem was the famous trial that she covered and published in The New Yorker and then in a book form, and where the banality of evil came from.
The notion that the Jewish elite was
complicit
with the Nazis. Yeah. So anyhow, that I really learned from her.
When you say you came under her influence, in what way would you say?
Well, I had dinner with her. We went to a Chinese restaurant in 84th and Broadway. I'd eat all the food she couldn't eat.
I meant more intellectual influence that you came under.
Well, you're asking me all these personal questions. I can remember this restaurant so clearly. For some reason, she could eat eggs, and I had a lot of egg foo young discussing Kant with her. But that's really where I got interested in issues of public space and public life, which is what my urban world has been about. Because she had a view which was very distinctive. It's a view that's put forward in her book, The Human Condition, which is her greatest book, although I don't think it's read except by specialists today. And it's a view that basically the public life and the public realm has to be between people who don't know each other, who are strangers to each other, and who don't argue on behalf of their own interests, but think more disinterestedly. So in her mind, this was, how do you get between beyond somebody saying, well, as a steel worker, what I believe is X, or as a steel worker boss, this is what I believe. How do they get beyond that? And it's a view that in some ways influenced me a lot. It's very counter to the other view of the time, which was of Jürgen Habermas's, which is that about the public life, which is that essentially people fight their corner, they have their interests, but the more they talk, the more they get outside themselves. And she thought that was all wrong. So that was very interesting to me, and I wanted to know what it actually meant in cities. You know, it was a philosophical debate they were having. So that's how I got into this urban thing. I just wondered what this philosophical problem meant on the ground.
Richard Sennett, you say that our impulse to cooperate is being deformed. What are the signs of that? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's happening in several ways. In one way, it's simply that there are fewer and fewer rewards for effective cooperation. Everybody stresses teamwork, you know, is a big buzzword. But I think particularly in corporations like high tech or financial services, you need to watch your back, because those are people kind of competitive situations. So I think part of the answer to this is that we're really not seeing the kind of teamwork where you really feel that you need the other person to do your own job as soldiers would. That's not true of modern capitalism, which is much more individualistic, even though it gives a lip service to cooperation. I think another reason for this has to do with cities, that people who are different are living further and further apart. The gated community, the campus. I mean, most modern cities are pretty much making kind of island culture out of the city. People stay in their own place, the place where they're familiar. Because of economic reasons, the urban area is becoming more homogeneous in terms of their class population. In the States, racial segregation or racial differentiation by neighborhoods is growing greater rather than lesser than it was in the 1960s. An astounding development. So if people are more segregated from each other, the chances of physically interacting and being in the same place at the same time are less. What we're getting is a social situation in cities and the workplace in which real cooperation is valued less and less. Nobody got a bonus in Wall Street for helping other people make money, that kind of thing. You know, I think that's very dangerous.
I want to talk about the bonuses in a second, but in terms of cities, certainly on the face of it, cities like New York, Toronto, London, where you spend a lot of time, seem very heterogeneous. They're racially, ethnically multicultural, a lot of immigrants.
I don't think so.
There's
lots of immigration. There are lots of differences in the city, but it's like a chemical mixture. In the places where people are, they don't mix together, they don't interact very much. What you're getting in, certainly in most European cities, is that the ethnic ghetto and now the religious ghetto is not weakening. So, you know, the fact that there are 360 languages spoken in London doesn't really argue that it's becoming a more cosmopolitan place. And I think there are economic reasons for that. One of the reasons I think people from these different communities shy away from each other is that they need the networks of people they know very locally in order to survive. So they're not, if you're a very poor Vietnamese, you're not going to put yourself in the middle of a Afro-Caribbean community, because you're not going to know anybody there who's going to be able to help you out. So I think there are very strong pressures driving this, and all these statistics about how many different languages and immigrant groups come to cities, I think, are very misleading.
Richard Sennett, since so much of what's behind the negative picture that you paint of our cities in terms of their being divided, gated, it seems to relate to an economic impulse, we have to go back to what's been referred to as the new capitalism, which has dominated the economy the last few generations. What has that done to the practice of cooperation, the practice of the effect of living in the city?
Well, one of the things it's done is very obvious. It's evicted more and more, not only poor people, but now middle-class people from the center of the city. I mean, the whole growth in income inequality, wealth inequality, is reflected urbanistically in who's buying, where are the choice places to buy to live. And they've become, in the last 20 years, the center of the city. And there are age reasons for that also. But basically, do you know what super prime real estate is? Super prime real estate is real estate that is really a kind of trophy and an investment. In New York, it starts at about $18 million. In London, it's about £12 million. And there's a whole market in this by people who've made vast, who essentially, the winners in this new capitalism dealing in this. The effect of super prime has been to raise prices of things which are not super prime. So we're seeing that, for instance, in London and New York, there are very few young people who live in the center of either of those cities. They can't afford it. So, you're getting age segregation. It's not a good thing. It's a disaster in terms of where you live when you have your first child, when you need that another bedroom, because you're going to have to move far from someplace nice to afford it. And that's what the effect of this has done. In a more subtle way, I'd say that what globalization has done to global cities is, and this is at the elite level, that it's created a class of people who are in cities but not attached to them. I'll give you an example of this. In New York, it used to be that at a certain point in your mobility up a corporation, you were meant to join boards of the local hospital. You're supposed to become a burger, take responsibility for the city, and so on. And my group and I have been able to quantify how that worked exactly, how many boards people were on related to their socioeconomic standing. And a little farther down the scale, people's charitable giving, depending on their income and so on. That system is broken down, because if you're working for Deutsche Bank and you're in Toronto 4 years, you don't become a burger. You don't take civic responsibility. And further down the scale, people's willingness to donate to local causes diminishes as well, because they're not going to be there for a long time. And the effect on the city is that what you've got is lots of people who are taking advantage of the city but not giving much back. That's a big problem. You've got to to make a city work, you can't just elect a mayor and say, you run it. People, the civil society is a real thing. And what we're seeing is that this new capitalism is eroding civil society, to put it in its most grandiose form.
And new capitalism means?
Technically, what it means is the kinds of work that is attracting the dominant share of investment, that it's high tech, global financial services, construction, you know, all these things that are related not to producing a toaster, but to creating a different kind of economy. And it means in the work sphere, the kinds of jobs which are very short-term, which don't have a narrative, long-term narrative. People don't get rewarded for service, for instance. If you get in this new economy, once you can get it in, the idea is that you should be changing jobs every 4 or 5 years. You stay with the same employer. There's something wrong with you. You're not ambitious enough. So the whole constellation of what it means to be at work is not something that's a narrative that, you know, when you think of the a long time ago of the organization man, he had a very fixed, horribly fixed narrative where he knew exactly, you know, if he played ball and he was a good boy and people liked him, that he'd climb the ladder in very articulate steps. Now what you have is no ladder, which is an opposite and equal evil, because you can't think strategically. You're constantly making sideways moves. There's a real issue about how do you build up your skills. In this Craftsman book that I wrote, one of the things my guys and I calculated was this thing called the 10,000 hours rule.
Malcolm Gladwell has popularized that idea.
He stole it. You know, but you need to spend 10,000 hours if you're going to put in that. In most jobs, that's a luxury today, all up and down the job ladder. And because people do so much lateral movement, say if I'm trained as a mainframe computer programmer and I find jobs are tough in that business, I find a job in something that's not programming, but it has to do with maybe product design and computers. And they need somebody with my former skills. I'm really not going to be able to do much more than just say, this is what I used to know. I can't grow them in this new environment. It's a big problem in industrial work, too, you know, where people do one kind of labor, become craftsmen and good at it. And then the jobs migrate to some other kind of field, from, say, toasters to solar panels. They're not transferable skills. So, as I say, it's the old way was horrible, and the new way has got its serious problems of a totally different kind, which is how do you get a narrative out of work? And for kids, it's a problem once they can find work, if they can find it, of how do you think strategically about getting from A to B to C to D. The other thing about this new economy is that in an increasing number of countries, it needs fewer and fewer workers to be very profitable. So in my view, higher levels of structural unemployment are going to become the norm. 15 or 18% of young people out of work, because you can run a very profitable economy with not very many people at work. So there are a different set of that's kind of issues that in the new economy we have to face, you know.
But economic disparity has led to a growing class divide, and you would think that might bring people who are more oppressed or disadvantaged together, but.
It doesn't. And part of the reason for that is that here's where culture enters the picture. I think that people think that the old ways of collective organizing are somehow undignified, that people are responsible individually for taking care of themselves. It's kind of a very Protestant notion. You know, if you don't believe in unions, for instance, you've tied an arm behind your back. There's nobody there to help you. I did some interviewing a couple of years ago with some people on Wall Street who were low-level people on Wall Street, who just when the crisis was, they were shedding jobs. And they were telling me about this familiar thing about emailing, you know, resumes to 1,000 companies and knowing nobody was reading those emails. And the idea that they would do something together about this, for instance, start, hire a room where they could all be in and appear as though they were a company themselves, never occurred to them. This was an individual problem. They were all in the same boat. They were emailing these resumes, but the idea that they might do even something that gave the appearance of collective action just wasn't there. And this is a real problem in the tech sector, which is kind of Ayn Rand gone wild. People are libertarians, want to be left alone, think that individualism is the key to innovation, so on. So, you know, that's the whole cluster of cultural attitudes which have repressed the idea that people need and can rely on or should rely on other people.
It's a great pleasure to have the chance to meet you. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me.
Richard Sennett in Toronto. Together, The Rituals, Pleasures, and Politics of Cooperation is published in paperback by Yale University Press. Writers and Company is produced by Mary Stinson. Nancy McElveen is associate producer. Technical operations by Tim Lorimer. You can also hear Writers and Company through online streaming on our website. Just go to cbc.ca/writersandcompany, and the show is available as a podcast. You can find book news, reading lists, and recommendations at cbcbooks.ca. The executive producer is Tara Mora. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. Next week from New York, Laurie Siegel, one of the most admired of writers, the author of Other People's Houses and Shakespeare's Kitchen, published a new novel last year at the age of 85. That's next week. I hope you'll join me. Until then, Happy New Year.